Hello, good evening. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm really glad there's so many people here. What we're hoping this evening is that after our presentations, it will open up into more of a discussion. But to begin, I just want to briefly outline the reasons why we decided to hold this discussion. The most recent edition of the Sao Paulo Biennale in the autumn of last year proposed a different format from its previous editions. Its intention was to transform the limits that have been imposed by its own crises into a differently structured event. And this would be one which would be a platform for the observation and reflection upon the culture and system of biennales internationally. From its proposal to its realization, this project generated a complex and often divisive debate within Brazil for reasons which will be outlined by the four speakers this evening. Although it aimed to provoke debates concerning the Biennale as an international phenomenon, the level of debate reached within Brazil has, perhaps inevitably, not been matched by its international and English-speaking reception. The aim of this event, therefore, is to translate aspects of its critical reception within Brazil and to raise points for discussion amongst an English-speaking audience. It's also regarded as an extension of our own involvement in the event itself. Members of TRAIN took part in the Biennale's series of public discussions with a panel that was concerned with how the Biennale is and has been perceived outside of Brazil. In short, with the Biennale as an event that is both national and international in scope, ambition, and repercussion. This panel included members of the TRAIN Research Center as well as Tanya Barson from Tate, and Moisés dos Anjos was involved in another of the series of public debates at the Biennale. One of the points that was raised by our panel was exactly the problem of the difference in complexity between the event's local specificity and its international reception. An overall aim, therefore, is to provide an opportunity for debates that are still taking place in Brazil to be continued here. And I hope that won't be restricted to this evening. I hope that debates concerning the Biennale will continue. Moisés dos Anjos, who is with us in TRAIN as a visiting fellow this year, myself, Elizabeth Lima, who's also with us as a visiting fellow this year, and Michael Asbury, in that order, will each speak for about 10 or 15 minutes on different aspects of the event. And then at the end of these four short presentations, we'd like to invite members of the audience to ask questions which can be addressed at any one of the four of us or be more open for different responses. So I'm going to hand over to Moisés, who's going to be speaking about the event from perspective of its curatorial concept. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. Well, I think that first thing first, because of that, I think that to talk about this edition of the São Paulo Biennial, it's necessary to understand the context in which it took place. A context which one can describe a situation of open crisis, or we could say of a double crisis. The first crisis, shared with so many other large-scale international exhibitions in the world, refers to the fact that it's necessary to rethink the reasons for doing such events. It's no news that these international shows are gradually becoming frustratingly similar to each other, and not only in terms of the adopted exhibition model, but in terms of the questions they raise, or the artists they select, and even in terms of the works they display. That is, from a systemic point of view, there is a contradiction between, on the one hand, the desire of each one of these biennials to appear as different from the others, and, on the other hand, the progressive similarity of what they exhibit. As a result, many of them become both superfluous at the international level and relevant to the specific cultural and geographical location where they take place. In the previous two editions of the São Paulo Biennial, an effort had been already made in order to reform the adopted model, almost unaltered since its first editions in the early 50s. From the 2004 edition, for example, there were no longer the so-called historical sections of the biennial, where important works from the past could be seen in the context of a contemporary show. Although that strategy had been important in the past, when few international exhibitions circulated in South America, it was thought that this was no longer the case, and the focus should be directed exclusively on the contemporary production. And from the 2006 edition, also the national representations were abolished, so that all the show could be articulated under our unified curatorial guidance. Although important, these changes had the immediate effect, maybe paradoxically, of aligning the São Paulo Biennial even closer to other biennials worldwide. It was clear, therefore, that much more had to be done in order to give the São Paulo Biennial a unique voice, that is, to distinguish itself among so many similar events and, at the same time, to be as international as possible. On the top of this general and shared crisis, the São Paulo Biennial has been the last few years through a second crisis, a crisis of a distinct nature and which was specific to it. And that crisis has to do, on the one hand, with an inefficient management model, and on the other hand, with several administrative irregularities committed by the current president of the biennial, Manuel Pires da Costa, and to the decision of the Biennial Council to ignore the widespread claims from different segments of society to persuade the president to abandon his post and to call a new election. A refusal that indicates, therefore, their decision to remain in power at all costs. This legitimacy crisis was largely publicized in the last few years in the Brazilian and international press and affected the confidence that the biennial previously had from its audience and also from its sponsors. Two facts are enough to illustrate the dimension of that crisis. In 2006, a then member of the Biennial Council, Edmar Cid Ferreira, was confirmed in the post even after being arrested by the police for crimes against the financial sector, money laundering, and gang formation. A fact that led the artist Cid Meirelles, the inviter to take part in the exhibition, to refuse to participate in the show or in any other biennial-related event, then or in the future, before Edmar was sacked from his post. The other telling fact is that in 2006, the São Paulo Biennial, based in the richest city of Brazil, São Paulo, raised only half of the money raised by the Mercosul Biennial in 2007, which takes place in the southern city of Porto Alegre in Brazil, which cannot compare to São Paulo in terms of potential availability of money for funding such events. And it was basically as a result of that internal crisis, simultaneously managerial and political, if not fundamentally ethical, that the São Paulo Biennial postponed the starting of the process for choosing the curator for its 2008 edition until August 2007, a moment when most of specialized commentators were already assuming that the edition would be canceled. It was at that moment, on the verge of the disaster, that the biennial started asking some Brazilian curators to submit a project, one of which would be selected by an international panel, international committee. To full disclosure, I must say that I was one of the 7 or 8 curators contacted at the time. And of these, all but two said no, refused to present a project, either because of the limited time to conceive and prepare a large-scale exhibition, or because the then unknown, but surely very limited budget, which would be available for the show. Although mainly because there was a now widespread feeling that making the exhibition under those conditions would serve neither the art nor the city, but only those who control the biennial, that is, its president and its council. For they would escape from the embarrassment of canceling the 2000 edition and from finally facing the crisis they were part of. The two curators who accepted to present a project were Marcio Doctors from Rio and Ivo Mesquita from São Paulo, who believed that even under those circumstances, the canceling of the biennial would cause more harm than long-term benefits. Once it became clear that they would be the only two contestants, Doctors decided to abandon the competition, being convinced by the biennial president to join forces with Mesquita and prepare a single project, which would make the competition redundant. Soon afterwards, Doctors declined the invitation, and Ivo Mesquita presented the project only on his name, under his name, which was called In Living Contact, and that was already October 2007. Basically, the project presented at that time was as following. That's the, for those who do not know, that's the Bienal Pavilion projected by Oscar Niemeyer in the late 50s. Basically, the project was the following. On the ground floor of the Biennial Pavilion, there would be a sort of square where a series of international conferences and debates about the past and the present of biennials would happen, thereby producing a critical and discursive account about the current understanding of large-scale exhibitions, and in particular, producing a critical account about the crisis of the São Paulo Biennial itself. In sum, it was supposed to be a space of self-criticality. Live performances, concerts, and parties would also be programmed for that space for the whole period of the biennial. On the top floor, in turn, would be transformed in a large and open research space, making widely available for the public the library and the archive of the biennial, as an attempt to add in another layer of discussion regarding the current state of the biennial in general and of São Paulo Biennial in particular. Between these two floors, a whole floor would be left empty, completely empty, compounding a radical curatorial project which would supposedly rethink the role of the São Paulo Biennial, the role that the São Paulo Biennial was to assume from then onwards, and to propose new models for the biennials in general. So, apart from the performances, there would be no artwork on view. The reason why the biennial was so nicknamed as the empty biennial, or as the biennial of the emptiness. Trespassing all this, the official title, In Living Contact, taken from a text by Lorival Gomes Machado for the catalog of the second biennial, this official title, In Living Contact, would suggest the undoing of borders, the excitement for the unknown other. So that was something it was expected the biennial would sign to the future of the biennial, and especially to rethink radically, in a radical way, the role that São Paulo Biennial would assume from then onwards. The absence of work of art in an art biennial was obviously the most debatable aspect of the project. In particular, the empty middle floor caused indignation to some artists, curators, critics, and cultural commentators. Personally, I was of the opinion that to leave that floor empty for the whole period of the biennial was absolutely coherent and adequate for such a radical curatorial project. For me, the empty floor was a perfect and eloquent metaphor for the crisis the institution was submerged, one which, through the shortage of an adequate budget, effectively limited the physicality of the event, and an intelligent way of expressing the wish of the curator to discuss and to face that crisis. That is, not only the supposed general crisis of the biennial model, but the specific crisis of the São Paulo biennial. But then, what happened? As the months passed and the news reached the newspapers, it became clear that the original project was changing. and the relative emptiness on both the grounds and on the top floor began to be filled by works of art. Or actually, how filled, being to my view one of the index of the central problem which surrounded this edition of São Paulo Biennial. That is, the fact that the radical nature of the original project lost its force before the pressures from those who are in charge of the Biennial Foundation. The fact is that, in the end, about 40 artists were invited, some of them to present performances and others to present physical works, either installations, videos, drawings, or objects. Scattered around those two floors, only half filling their immense floor surface, a mix of young and senior artists presented works that, in their vast majority, had already been presented somewhere else in recent past, sometimes in other venues in São Paulo itself, and sometimes just a few weeks before the biennial inaugurated. Well-known works by the likes of Sophie Kahl, Marina Abramović, Eiza Ligia Attila were installed next to work by younger artists like Leia Mirabrande and Nicolas Robieu. Before proceeding, I just want to make it absolutely clear that I'm not complaining about the presence of art in an art biennial. That's not the point, it should be obvious. The point is that in such a situation, that inclusion, the inclusion of art, diverged frontally from the originally proposed project and weakened it as an institutional instrument of self-criticality. I should add, moreover, that the quality of the work selected is not at stake in my appraisal here. Actually, some of them were, to my view, really good. But in spite of them, it seemed to me a weak show. And I would give you two points which, to my view, worked against the exhibition itself. The first was that there wasn't any discernible, cohesive theme or question to articulate or to confront those works. In part, it may be the result of the fact that in between the announcement of the project and the inauguration of the show, a previous collaborator of Ivo Mesquita, Ana Paula Cohen, became the show co-curator. That's not to blame her, of course, but only to highlight that most of the time, I had the impression of being not in a single exhibition, but rather in two juxtaposed ones. And the second point is that, paradoxically, given what I have just said, the artworks were in many moments flattened down both by the intrusive exhibition displays adopted, a project by Gabriel Sierra, one of the participant artists, and by designed printed on the floor, which was a project by Dora Longo Bahia, another participant artist. The second striking change between project and reality was the reduction of the library archive dimension of the show on the top floor to a transparent reading room housing only a selection of catalogs and publications of many other biennials from distinct parts of the world, some of them long defunct. And that's still more surprising when several of Cohen's previous projects as a curator dealt exactly with issues involving archive and documentation, and several of the projects on view, possibly chosen by her, dealt with these very same questions. Similar frustrating were the talks and seminar, for although there were plenty of them, most lacked criticality, a feature which was made still more apparent because of the lack of public to follow and press the discussion. Apparently, the public, including artists, curators, and critics, took the proposal of the talks and seminar in a cynical mood. On the ground floor, in turn, many performances and events actually took place, although most of the time the so-called square was left sadly empty, as half empty or half filled with a few works and a video lounge was the whole floor, the whole ground floor. In a clear compromise, in my interpretation, between the original project and the pressure to present a more conventional and less risky exhibition. And given the lack of resources and time, this compromise resulted in a very lackluster show. But then, the middle floor was left empty. And then, the most diverse reaction to this empty space emerged, some positive, others negative. But it was difficult to become indifferent to what was now being called by the curators the open plan, a strong reminder of the original curatorial project, but which was now being enveloped in an architectural history discussion, thereby neutralizing its potential to generate critical discussion. Others after me will talk in more detail about some of these responses, both from art critics and from the public. What I want to point out by now is that the several confrontations between those who wanted to occupy the empty space and the unwillingness of the Biennial Foundation to permit such unplanned actions make absolutely evident, as already demonstrated by what happened in the other two floors, the incapacity of the institution to fully assume the radical project announced by Ivo Mesquita back in late 2007. That is, to assume the show as a symbolic space for living contact with the other, with the different, with the possibility of another kind of institution, which the São Paulo Biennial is not yet. Sadly, and apparently against the original intent, the curators ended up helping to perpetuate the crisis of the São Paulo Biennial, or even to aggravate it even further, instead of proposing any way out from the crisis. In fact, I'm convinced that only strong institutions are capable of willingly assuming projects that make them fragile ones, and therefore apt to embrace real changes. And as the São Paulo Biennial is no longer as strong as to use it to be as an institution, it is no surprise that it failed when adopting such a radical project, either by changing some of its main features or by refusing the contact with the unpredicted implied in its initial formulation. But maybe the biggest problem is to know if the São Paulo Biennial will be able to, as in the well-known passage in Beckett's text, to try again and to fail better in future editions. Thank you. Now I'd like to invite Michael. It's Michael, it's, oh sorry, Isabel.
This edition of the Biennale's concern with history extended from the recovery of its past events towards a consideration of how the present edition would be remembered. There were therefore ongoing attempts to discuss, document, and disseminate the event as it happened via its free weekly newspaper, website, and public talks. It seems inevitable, however, that one of the events that will be fixed to the story of this edition was one that was not planned, by the Biennale, that is, and one that was not much reflected on within the event's own systems of documentation. On the day of the Biennale's first opening to the public, an organized invasion was carried out by a group of taggers, or pichadores. This event has since provided journalists with useful rhetorical fuel to address the Biennale's theme of living contact. And subsequently, the invasion has become indissociable from critical examination of the Biennale's curatorial project. Reports and analysis of the Pichasson invasion have been wide, conflicting, occasionally emotive, and often divisive. As one starting point for our discussion, therefore, my aim here is simply to outline the facts as I understand them. Amongst a group of approximately 40 Pichadores, the principal organizer was Rafael Augustaitz, a former scholarship student of the Academy of Fine Arts in Sao Paulo. He had been expelled earlier in 2008 for organizing a similar attack, staged at the art school and presented as his final coursework. More recently, he had led the invasion of an exhibition of street art at a commercial gallery, Shock Cultural, in Sao Paulo. The plan of attack for the Biennale, as briefly outlined in his flyer manifesto for this event, was to enter the building as a group and to register protest in the form of messages for the people. And this is the flyer that was distributed to help organize the invasion. Indistinguishable from other members of the public, the group entered the building normally. They assembled on the second floor and began to tag the walls and windows. I was downstairs at the time, so I didn't see it, but I have a short video to show what happened next. And another aspect of this was that people were simultaneously taking photos and videos as things took place. Oops. If I can make it play. from downstairs. The first indication that something was taking place was the shouts from security staff and members of the public, which was followed by a charge of pichadores fleeing down the ramps and towards the exit en masse. The main exits were then locked, and the final group to escape did so by smashing through a large pane of glass and escaping into the park. One member of the group, Carolini Pivetta de Morcia, was apprehended and eventually arrested after failing to provide evidence of her identity and address. The Biennale's official response, which appeared the next day in the form of a press release signed by the two curators, was to unambiguously condemn the action as one of vandalism. Caroline Pivetta de Morta has remained imprisoned without habeas corpus, and she will reportedly face a jail sentence of up to 3 years. As the art and popular press continue to debate the invasion and its consequences, the Biennale's steadfast condemnation of the attack has become tangled by association with the severe justice handed out to her. Speculative questions continue to be posed in relation to the nature of the invasion itself. Is Auguste Aitz an artist or an outsider? Was he manipulative in his hierarchical relationship to the other members of the group, or was he heroic? Or was his intervention, as some have suggested, simply a valid response to the theme and ambitions of the Biennale? The curators could perhaps have used different tactics, embraced the invasion, left the graffiti in place, and claimed back ownership of it. It was precisely such comfortable accommodation of a marginal practice that Raphael Auguste Aitz was attempting to upset. But such a deft countermove is perhaps incompatible with the nature of this attack, as one that was both spectacular and violent. It was not a benign happening, and its capacity to provoke panic or fear gave it a charge. It's unlikely that any institution on the scale of a biennale, no matter what critical acumen it might claim, would be permitted to either commission or take ownership of such an event after the fact. To a certain extent, one can comprehend the Biennale's reluctance to have its focus derailed by something as obviously spectacular, audacious, and scene-stealing. And thus, the fact that the Biennale has not yet invited any open analysis of the Pichasau invasion within its own newspaper or website. Whether we like it or not, however, it has taken hold of attention, and the relationships that it has established to the Biennale's project and its public reception demand calm untangling, if only to avoid any easily reached assumptions about who is in the right and who is in the wrong. This is, of course, not the first time that the particular type of event that is an international biennale has provoked unplanned protests, interventions, or counter-biennales, and it probably won't be the last. Whatever position Auguste Aitz's work merits within such a genealogy, he seems to have achieved a goal set out in his manifesto flyer, which was to stage something that intent and in effect cannot be comfortably diagnosed as being either good or bad. And that's the only points I want to make about this particular part of the Biennale. And now I'm going to hand over to Elizabeth Lima, who's going to talk about one of the performances that was organized as part of the program. Yes.
The second floor was empty. In the folder distributed to the public, the space and its conception is defined like this. Second floor, free plan. This time, the second floor is completely open, revealing its structure and offering to the visitant a physical experience of the architecture of the building. What could be experienced here is the wide space, the wideness, an experience of openness. Some air to breathe in the narrow and fully occupied art space in nowadays. A few of possible otherwise I suffocate, screamed Deleuze. For Ricardo Basbaum, a Brazilian artist, The subject of emptiness is necessary to construct a break for thought, through which we could have a sight or a vision of gaps, escape areas, lines of flights, making it possible to emerge other fluxes to the event and to the world of art in general. This gesture, however, according to him, could have been effectuated in a less literal way. Maybe we could access another way this openness, such as in Mauricio Yanez's performance. During 13 days, Mauricio Yanez carried out an untitled performance with the subtitle of The Kindness of Strangers. Here, the emptiness leaves the literality and presents itself on the interstices of the contacts and encounters. The artist lived in the biennial building for 2 weeks, having begun his performance completely naked and depending on the public to eat, sleep, and to dress him. In his program, Yanez stated he would not talk to anyone during the period of the performance. To Folha de São Paulo newspaper, he said he wanted to make his performance undressed of any artifices in the attempt to clean and reduce to the essence his action, adding that his work is related to the gaps in verbal communication and that only the presence is able to fulfill the empty spaces. In the gap opened between the biennial and the public by the events that took place on the first day of exhibition that Isabel brought for us today, Yanez put himself in a state of extreme vulnerability. In an interview given to Cristiana Tejo, the artist says that his creative process starts from an attempt to think or and with the other. On the beginning of the experiment, he occupied different spaces in the biennial, but on the second week, he moved to the second floor and stayed there until the end of the work. In an unexpected way, Yanez activated the empty space, bringing the public into it. By his presence there, the public was authorized to bring their own works into the space this time. "People went there to play music to me," he tells in an interview. "Two groups gave me a performance. It was very beautiful to see that by my work, the void became a space opened to expression. This," he continues, "was forbidden, but my presence made it possible to the public to do something that they couldn't have done before. With this work, I was immediately drawn to ones of Tunga's instauration. In 2001, he constructed an ambient in the opening of the Banco of Brazil Cultural Center. In this instauration, Tunga brought to this cultural center that was placed in the center of São Paulo, the surrounding area, the people that use it to live there on the streets, their way of living, and by doing this, he brought into an art space the urgency of Brazilian social context. Yanez didn't bring starving people to the biennial. He brought his naked body, a very well-fed body, that day by day became more and more dressed and that also received book materials to draw and affectionate notes or cards. According to Almika Parque, this was the performance that mobilized the most the biennial public. Why did so many people want to go to the biennial to bring Yanez something? How could it be that in a city like São Paulo, with thousands of miserable living undressed on the streets, this naked man was being dressed and fed with such a kindness and in such a short period of time? In a very subtle way, our kindness, our hospitality, but also our guilty, our unkindness, and our violence as a society, and perhaps our desire to do things in a different way, our desire to transform the terrible situation in which we all live, all that were present and presented in Yanez's work and not the public response that, of course, completed the work. More than that, in a condensed action, Yanez revealed what everyone knows. What naked king is brought out in his performance? Maybe many of them, but one for sure. The distance between art and life in our world, but also their continual attempt to connect. In one of the two only times Yanis broke his silence rule and, in a way, got out of his work, he did it because he had to talk with the security staff in order to ask them to let go out three kids that had taken some food from the things given to him by the public. After the 13 days of performance, the second floor was empty again. The 28th São Paulo Biennial was called, in an ironic and depreciative way, the empty biennial. For me, the emptiness was the most powerful trace in this biennial. Installed in the middle of a big event of art, the presence of the emptiness, in Baltasar Caldas' words, could create opposition and resistance to the aggressive and limited objectification of the commodities world in globalized capitalism. The emptiness introduces a pause within which it's possible to think and to feel. When we insert a pause, our body is invaded by multiple sensations that are usually blocked by a great amount of images, feelings, and ideas read and formatted to be seen, felt, thought. This avalanche of unexpected sensations that invade us in the silence of the pause demands new images, new ideas, new thoughts, new expressions. But was the biennial, the event, the institution, ready to support and receive what such a radical gesture could bring to life? In part intentionally, but going further than this intention, by the non-programmed reactions from artists, critics, and public, the 28th São Paulo Biennial ended up bringing out issues that are crucial to contemporary art world. The curatorship role, the tension between curatorial projects and artists' poetics, the role played by the art institutions, the place reserved to the public, how the public is invited to participate, and how its participation escapes from what is expected. Beyond these questions, in a country marked by extreme inequalities as Brazil is, the biennial and the facts that took place from it made visible the complex relations between art and its systems and the social and cultural inclusion-exclusion process. In this sense, we could think that even if not intentionally, the biennial made visible the power battle that traverses the field of art. It made visible also the potency of invention that inhabits everyone and that could be spread all over the actors that play a role in the art field today, bringing the responsibility to think what art is capable of in a world like ours. Finally, the biennial and its implications showed that it was not prepared to deal with the spreadable potency of invention. It becomes evident the distribution of the sensible that is played here. For Jacques Rancière, the distribution of the sensible is at the center of the relation between aesthetics and politics, on revealing the existence of a common world which defines forms of visibility, exclusive places, moments in times, and kinds of activities. According to Rancière, the distribution of the sensible allows to see who takes part in the common world in conformity with the activities performed and defines for each one the fact of being or not visible, having or not a voice in the shared space. In another work presented on the biennial, Mauricio Yanez installed three adhesive pieces on the floor of the building. Each one indicates a zone or a state in the communication process. Silence area, monologue area, dialogue area. It poses to us the demand of being aware to when and how art in its system it is developing a monologue with itself and when and how there is a dialogue with its environment. It also suggests the importance of a silence area, a space for silence, in order to be able to install new forms of dialogue and encounters. I call Michael now.
My presentation is a form of what the papers say or what the papers have said. And in that spirit, I thought that it would make sense to include as my sole image what the biennial paper did not say. Isabel, who curated an exhibition by Nicolas Hobio, one of the artists included in the biennial last year, drew my attention to the censorship of the biennial's publication of certain drawings by Hobio in its newspaper. And here are two examples of these censored drawings. The one on the left is an image of a proposed monument featuring the figure of the president of the foundation, Manuel Pires da Costa. And on the right is an image of Hobio's vision of a possible future for the biennial as a kind of theme park and car park. So, even before the curator and the curatorial premise for last year's São Paulo Biennial were announced, serious concerns had been raised in the Brazilian press about the administration of the event and the lateness of the appointment, as Moacir has already mentioned. Prior to such announcements, the newspaper Folha de São Paulo uncovered a document stating the institution's debts running around the figure of £1 million, which included outstanding payments to artists, international museums, lawyers, accountants, transport companies, architects, and Brazilian and international curators. Such debts related not only to the 2006 edition, but some dated back also to 2004. The largest slice of the debt, however, was towards TPT Communications, a company whose board of directors included the current São Paulo Biennial Foundation President, Manuel Pires da Costa. Other than the Biennati journal that TPT was appointed to produce, the president's wife had been hired to undertake the pavilion's landscape design, and his son-in-law was charged with its insurance coverage. The newspaper also emphasized that the biennial's charter prohibits any business being established between its president and the foundation itself, for obvious reasons. According to the statement made by the president, the violation of the charter was made in order to salvage the institution, which since 2002 had been considered in a state of bankruptcy. Whether we assume this as a smokescreen, as Folha de São Paulo suggests, or not, the date not only refers to the previous administration, but inadvertently brings the selected curator for the 2008 edition, Ivo Mesquita, into the equation. And before I go any further, I must state my agreement with the consensus that Ivo Mesquita is in no way implicated in the alleged irregularities, nor corruption, revolving around the administration debts and so on. Such debts meant, for example, that the Brazilian participation at the 2007 Venice Biennial had to be paid by the artist's own commercial galleries, for example. The Association of the Venice representation and the Biennial Foundation had indeed been a contentious issue for the administration in 2002. In 2000, Manuel Pires da Costa's predecessor, Carlos Bracker, announced his intention to forge a partnership between the Associação 500 Anos, the 500 Years Association, and the national representation at the 2001 Venice Biennial. The 500 Years Association was formed by Edmar Cid Ferreira, himself president of the Biennial Foundation for two consecutive mandates, 94 and 96, and who in 1998 created the association in order to organize a biennial-style exhibition celebrating 500 years since the discovery of Brazil by the Portuguese in 1500. The exhibition, which was held in 2000 at the Biennial Pavilion itself, allegedly drained funding from the foundation, causing the decision by the then president, Carlos Bracker, to postpone the event until 2002. Bracker was then forced to sack Ivo Mesquita, who had been appointed as the curator for the 2001 edition of the São Paulo Biennial, following Mesquita's own announcement that he would resign due to the postponement, which would mean missing the opportunity for a celebratory 50th anniversary edition of the São Paulo Biennial, the first the inaugural event being in 1951. Bracas' suggestion of associating Edmar Cid Ferreira's organization with the Venice Biennale nominations and national representation exhibition were described by the then president of the Museum of Modern Art in São Paulo as a clear attempt by Cid Ferreira to manipulate the foundation in order to fund international itinerancy for his 500 years exhibition. Now indicted for corruption with regard to the activity of his bank, the Banco de Santos, as well as arts funding irregularities, Cid Ferreira had from the late 1990s infiltrated the Brazilian art circuit not only as a self-proclaimed philanthropist, sponsoring large-scale exhibitions, international exhibitions, through the agency of the 500 Years Association, later renamed Brazil Connects, and the Banco de Santos, but also becoming inextricably connected to the administration of the Bienal itself. Interestingly, the current president, Manuel Pires da Costa, now in his third mandate, began his series of three consecutive biennials by appointing the same curator Braca had hired for the replacement of Ivo Mesquita back in 2001, following the Venice scandal. The name of that curator was Afonso Hug, who curated the 2002 and 2004 editions. Given this brief overview, which Moacir, I think, went more in detail than I could, of the biennial's troubled institutional history, it seems understandable that the art circuit in Brazil seemed reluctant to embark on a curatorial project for the 2008 edition, all the more so given that it had less than a year left for its production and no clear funding guidelines. Since 2006, the system of direct nominations had been replaced by a call for projects, although the foundation found itself inviting applications in this instance. Few were prepared to submit for 2008. The Rio-based curator Márcio Doctus project had initially been accepted, but upon realizing that his project had been the sole contender, he resigned. Upon the request of President Manuel Pires da Costa, Doctors agreed to discuss a collaborative project with Mesquita. My version differs a little bit from Moacir, but I'm basing it on what I read from Folha de São Paulo, so maybe Moacir is more aware of the ins and outs. The combined Doctors and Mesquita project proposed an empty pavilion which would be temporarily occupied by a series of seminars focusing on the crisis of the biennial. It's also proposed as a second stage an exhibition based on the theme of the void, which would be held as the 2010 edition. Upon being denied the latter, Doctors resigned for a second time, leaving Ivo Mesquita to attempt a combination of both concepts within a single edition. That is, an empty pavilion floor that would stand as a conceptual comment of the institutional crisis, a seminar series that would dissect the crisis through several thematic round tables, and an exhibition that would place the art in living contact between public and institution. In hindsight, Ivo Mesquita's theme, in vivo contato, or in living contact, only exacerbated the controversy that would mar the event from its opening day. It could be argued that what had led to such a theme was not exactly a desire to create a space for living contact, as an answer perhaps to the previous 2006 edition, curated by Lisette Lanhado, which asked the question, how to live together, but a desire to rescue some of the concepts that Ivo had envisaged for the cancelled 2001 edition, originally planned to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the event. In Living Contact was, after all, a quote from Lorival Gomes Machado's statement as the curator of the inaugural exhibition in 1951. And I quote the paragraph from where it comes from. In its own definition, the biennial should fulfill two main tasks: to place modern art in Brazil, not only in simple confrontation, but in living contact with the art of the rest of the world. while São Paulo would attempt to conquer a central position within the artistic world, end quote. The 28th biennial project, upon being announced, provoked fierce criticism precisely because it would considerably reduce the type of interaction between local and international circuits which Gomes Machado had in mind in 1951. This dissatisfaction was initially voiced by the Brazilian galleries and some artists in relation to the vastly reduced space of the show and consequently the lack of an opportunity to showcase the local production to an international jet-setting art audience, collectors, curators, and critics. I'll conclude by briefly outlining the perceptions of the event by three important figures within the Brazilian art circuit: the artist Ricardo Basbaum, the art historian Araci Amaral, and curator Paulo Herkenhoff. For Basbaum, Mesquita's proposal was courageous in that it obliged the Brazilian art circuit to take position, whether in favor or against, and thus a moment of reflection and pause was installed amongst the hitherto normalization of the ascendance of Brazilian arts within the international circuit. Basbaum's main contention with the curatorial premise was with the exhibition itself and the homogenizing imposition set in place by the curators. He argues that the combination of Dora Longo Bahia's floor installation and Gabriel Serra's plywood units unified the works on display in the third floor, denying individual works their own communicative space. Basbaum is perhaps too generous in celebrating the biennial's newspaper that brought, according to him, in its pages, different directions, multiple voices in contemporary arts, and that included news from the everyday, such as the Brazilian and North American elections, crime, and sport. Given, as we know, and these are examples, that it was subject to institutional censorship too. Araci Amaral's review of the event is far less generous. There are no redeeming factors in her opinion, particularly the notion of the void. And I quote a section of her review, I think it was for the Estado de São Paulo, if I remember correctly. To place as a focus of admiration a space conceived by Niemeyer that we have used for more than 50 years could have been a project for the São Paulo Biennial of Architecture. But this is the 28th biennial. There is thus no reason for it. It suggests a lack of ideas, conceptions, time, budget, or all of the above. If it was a question of creating a polemic about provocation, then the objective was reached. But the void, for sure, is an omission. It has nothing of rebelliousness, and if the curator, Ivo Mesquita, accepted the rules of the game, one could say that he does more for the presidency of the institution than merely saving the biennial. End quote. Perhaps the harshest voice remains that of Paulo Herkenhoff, who poses the question, does the biennial want Brazil to feel nostalgia for the dictatorship? Herkenhoff, in his article, raises several historical instances where artists rebelled against institutions during the dictatorship, concluding that the fate of Caroline da Mota, the tagger caught during the event, is indeed unacceptable. Herkenhoff concludes by claiming that, I quote, if the void was indeed an open space to discuss the institution, the extraordinary graffiti would have been incorporated into the ethical and political project of the 28th biennial. The graffiti is already one of the most memorable factors of this edition. With more repression, it will shift from being a problem of excessive penitentiary rigor to become an issue of the study, for the study, of curatorial ethics and aesthetic debates. If the Biennial Foundation is not careful, we will come to conclude that it is the principal problem with the 28th Biennial and the political structure that supports it. What will save Brazil and the Biennial will not be incarceration, but Mário Pedrosa when he said that art is the experimental exercise of liberty, end quote. The failure of the project to create a viable institutional critique from within, described in the press as a gradual de-Hans-Hackerization, had already led to the resignation of co-curator Thomas Mulcair before the event inaugurated. Mulcair is said to have resigned due to the rejection of the idea for a public display of the institution's accounts. However, despite all compromises agreed prior to the inauguration, I tend to agree with Herkenhoff that it will be the reaction of the curatorial team to the reality of living in contact that history will hold against them. The general consensus is that the totally discredited President Manuel Pires da Costa was saved by the fact that the event, after so much confusion, actually took place, but that his redemption occurred at the expense of Ivo Mesquita's credibility. When Ivo Mesquita was fired as the curator of the São Paulo Biennial in 2000, Guatemoc Medina, the Mexican art critic and curator, wrote an article about the whole incident entitled A Theory of on Defeat, in which he claimed that that curators, in general, possess a perverse desire for compromise. Perhaps for Ivo Mesquita, the compromise in this instance went too far. Thank you very much.
Switched on? Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, we're assembled and ready to take any questions. If there are any. Yeah, hi.
The ruling classes that rule Brazil under the dictatorship are now trying to do this through the arts and big business.
Sorry.
I didn't.
Having a translation.
It seems to me quite simple to say that it's more complex. It's not the same class, I think. I can't do this relation like this. I think it's a completely different situation now, and. Art, there is a lot of projects in art in all over the country with different people in different classes. It's not something.
I think that, in fact, you cannot make this direct linkage between the two moments. But in fact, there is an elite in Brazil. Especially from the 90s, from the early 90s, when there was a lot of change in the legislation in public funding of cultural events in Brazil, part of this elite has appropriated part of these funds to promote themselves through the arts, through the culture, and the case of Brazil Connects that Michael has mentioned is maybe the biggest example of that. And the fact that Edmacy de Ferreira was persecuted because of the many problems, many irregularities during this process is maybe an evidence that this era is coming to the end. It's going, the laws that regulate this public fund is being under transformation the last few years, so shortly we'll have different rules to regulate this, the access to these public funds.
Because I think
Yeah. Yeah, that's an index of the problem in Brazil, of the privatization of access to funds to deal with art. I mean, the most of the public museums in Brazil have not direct access to these funds. It's much easier for the private sector to have access to these funds because it's tax, how would say, the discounts.
Tax
exemption scheme, which in fact the deduction is decided by the enterprise, by the firms, by the private sector. So it's not a public fund, which the Minister of Culture decides where to put the money into that museum, to that award. So it's the private sector itself, which decides where the due tax are to be applied, invested. So it's a very perverse mechanism. At the same time, it promotes the arts, promotes the culture, but promotes to the interests of the private sector. That's the reason why you can't find museums with art. Most of the museums don't have funds to buy art and to. Yes.
There is a, not a direct relation, but there is a kind of logic to your comment in that the military dictatorship came down at the time in which neoliberalism was emerging on the world scale, and that in Brazil, that was the first president properly elected was the most corrupt ever, Collor. But that also kind of is indicative of a kind of attempt to adapt to so-called first world models in a very kind of precarious and makeshift way, which took place in haste after during the 1980s and early 90s, so that laws were put in place that were based on the neoliberal model, but without actually looking at the public-funded institutions themselves and what they needed. It's a kind of in-haste adaptation of a...
Just want to add that in this situation, there is also a lot of projects in the social field that we can't connect like this. We can find that there is a lot of things happening in a very precarious situation without funding, but lots of things happening out.
It's obvious that there would be, because Brazilian people are just so full of energy. There had to be. I just felt very sad. I couldn't find it.
Sorry, you've got another question queued up. Thank you.
Really, it's a question for Isabel, but maybe for others as well. There seem to be two interpretations offered of the taggers, one that they were making some kind of critical intervention and one that they were violent hoodlums of some kind. But has someone actually had any contact with those involved and found out what they thought they were doing through the process? I understand the suggestion that there was a kind of like a ringleader with one agenda and other people involved, but it seems to me that that's a very kind of simple way of looking at what went on, and that there is the violence you talk about, which undermined one level of intervention, was to some extent a reaction to the reaction of the curatorial staff and the locking of the doors and the attempt to remove people, and that confrontation was a confrontation of violence on two sides, not just in relation to the taggers. Sorry.
I think in answer to the first part of the question, I think it's very clear that Rafael Augusta is in charge. I mean, he positions himself in a very different style to other taggers. He saw, I mean, and because this is outlined in how he writes about it mainly in the form of a kind of flyers and quite a secretive way, but that he saw it as the Biennale as a kind of culmination of this three-stage event that went from his sort of graduation to moving on to the gallery to the Biennale, this sort of progress. He's ended up at the Biennale just within months of his graduation. And I think that he's not naive. He's actually really thought about what his approach is. And what he's doing, in effect, and he has quite a valid logic, is that street art is something that's been accommodated in a very comfortable way by institutions. We love the fact that it's secretive and it's ethical. They have their own code of ethics. And he's noticed how well it's been accommodated by museums and galleries and commercial galleries. And he's one step ahead because he's denying everything we think is good about street art. He's becoming an author, and he's assuming a hierarchy. He's looking for attention. All these things we assume are great about street art, he's not allowing us to take hold of it in that way. And in that sense, what he's doing differs from the piece of sound that goes on everywhere in Sao Paulo. And the second point, when I was speaking about violence, what I mean is that for him, the violence was something that was essential to what he does. It's sort of desired by the invasion. If it was curated, if they said, oh, let's have a meeting and you can invade the Biennale on the first day and it'll be all really exciting, then he would have said no, because it wouldn't have been violent enough. And when I was speaking of violence, it wasn't just physical violence, but it was frightening. I mean, especially when you couldn't see what was going on. It was frightening because it was unexpected. And you couldn't possibly curate, it's logically impossible to curate an unexpected happening. So when I was speaking of it as violent, that was what you liked about it, but at the same time, it's exactly what prevents it from being possible, from being accommodated by the institution, because the moment you invite it, it's destroyed. Does that answer the question? Yeah, sure.
In the article that I mentioned by Paulo Hergenhoff, he makes several comparisons, and one of which is to talk about Elio Itzica's invasion of the Museum of Modern Art in Rio in 1965 with the people from the shantytown dressed in parangolés, an event where the guards of the museum expelled everyone, and there was a confrontation. So he's talking about the position of the curators in that kind of instance in comparison with the position of the curators with the São Paulo Biennial. In all the instances, the historical instances that he mentions, the position of the curators were with the interventions rather than against. And that's Hergenhoff's main criticism of the current situation.
At least to try to understand the interventions, yes. Yeah. Not just to reject them.
Yes, because as I understood, you were talking about the response was very violent also. And I think comparing to the Helios situation, we live in a very violent situation, social situation. So I think understand, not putting on it's, of course, he has his own interests, but the violence that took place is also outside. We can see it. So,
I mean, the whole event was already announced via the internet, and the response by the curators, even before the biennial opened, was that they would be very hard, and these graffiti people would not be allowed in the building. So they more or less set the stage for it to happen, for the confrontation to happen.
Sorry, I don't want to hog things, but it strikes me that in the way that nature abhors a vacuum, it probably also like setting up the need for this event to happen through the discursive context that the BNR suggests, which is, I'm sure, part of your point. In which case, it seems really strange. It's like when police entice you to commit a crime. There's this element of enticement in it, which seems to go against natural justice to react so violently.
In contrast, within the newspaper, they did have this little section where they were like, we want you to do something in the empty space. We want you to come and use it. But, yes, there's a difference between the sort of planned and unplanned. Teresa. I'm sorry.
If I understood Moisia's presentation correctly, the upper floor was devoted to the archive or of the presentation of past biennials. And my question would be, it seemed that the void on the second floor only made sense in a way with the full upper floor, that you would have this chronology upstairs that would suddenly abruptly end, and you were forced with this kind of the absence of history that would be beckoning and calling for filling. And I'm wondering if then, two questions. One, if the reaction in the press it didn't seem very sensitive to that contrast. And the second question, was the curating, the staging of that history interesting in its own right? Was there, for example, in the 2001 to 2008 return, was there a sense that this was underlined or on the contrary, banalized, rendered inoperative?
I'm not sure if I understood. The first question is I wasn't there all the time. I don't know if there was this relationship. The relationship between the 2001 and 2008 biennials was made by someone.
It was 2002 because it was canceled.
2001 and 2008. Sorry, 2001 and 2008. I didn't think about that. It wasn't something that I thought about. What I thought about the second floor, the emptiness of the second floor in comparison to the half-filled third floor, was that those works were put upstairs, some sort of emptied the emptied space of meaning. I mean, the emptiness of the second floor could only be a radical statement if the project was kept as it was originally thought. It's a big archive space on the top floor and a space for discussion, for verbalization of the crisis, for the discursive space on the ground floor. I think that once you compromise it and put some objects, some works of art on the ground, on the top floor, so it sort of emptied the meaning of the empty space. And that's the reason why it was rephrased afterwards in terms of an architectural historical discussion to recover the building, to offer the building to the population so that the population from the São Paulo inhabitants could actually feel that empty space, which was created by NMI in the 50s, which nevermore had been offered in that way to the population, and so on. That's how I feel. But
yeah, maybe the question arises from the fact that we didn't really explain the layout of the third floor. The third floor was a mixture of exhibition space, and at the back there were a small room with exhibition catalogs from previous biennials and other biennials from around the world, rather than the archive itself. The idea of having the archive open to the public on the third floor wasn't taken to the end, the idea. And on the other side, there was a kind of a conference room closed with curtains. So it was a kind of a very mixed space and with no very strong statement. A lot of plywood structures dividing artworks and archive and a kind of plywood platform for the public to sit around in the auditorium. It was very difficult to speak at the auditorium because of the noise in the space. There was very few people actually sitting in the public, but you could hear that this almost deafening sound from kids and the screams from the exhibition. So it was a very confused layout.
I hope this question is not too rude to ask you. I've read some articles which said that you made some empty spaces because of the lack of budget. And if you've got sufficient budget, would you still make void space or not?
Who's the question to?
I'm asking just one question. So, if you've got,
but for everybody or for
no, anyone.
I think the idea of the empty space was kind of a critique, but at the same time an attempt to compromise a difficult situation, to resolve a situation. I think that the question should be directed to the curator of the exhibition, not to us.
It's just that given the situation, the lack of time and the lack of budget to make a, let us say, a normal biennial, I think that the idea of the empty space was a very intelligent strategy, curatorial strategy. But only if it had kept its original radical states, radical status. I mean, once he compromised it, the whole thing dismantled. I think that it was a valid and intelligent strategy at that moment. I don't know if he had the budget or in the time, if he would do the same thing. That's something that you can only ask Ivo Mesquita. But I think given the situation, given the context, it was a very intelligent and valid strategy.
I'm trying to think of a way of playing devil's advocate for Ivo Mesquita's thought with this creation of this empty space and how one might have reacted as a curator, having had this very clear image of a space which was intended as some kind of space of possibility. And perhaps it might have felt to the curators that the appearance of these taggers was actually quite aggressive, because it was closing down that space of possibility for other users. For instance, how would Mauricio Yanez's work have functioned in a space that had been entirely tagged in that way? I mean, I think there's the politics are really quite complicated. It reminds me of the kind of political wrangles I used to get into in the late 60s when I got totally confused as to, you know, everything kind of went round in a circle. I wasn't sure which side I was on anymore. The other thing that I wondered about was, from a distance, what one heard about this Biennale, which was extremely attractive, as Mercius just said, was this very simple statement that this was going to be this empty Biennale, and rather a simple statement in the same way as Okui's Gwangju was a kind of simple statement. In fact, when one saw it, it was similarly, I think, rather compromised. But Okui's Gwangju Biennale was a kind of summing up of other biennials, or no, other exhibitions that he'd seen, an annual report. And I wondered whether part of why Ivo Mesquita kind of had to reject the Taggers was that he was holding on to this curatorial idea really meant a lot to him, and he needed to preserve that image of this empty space, this space of possibility in which things could continue to happen without a sense that something else had already happened. I don't know.
I think that's a very good question, but exactly this kind of question which was not raised by the curatorial team. They just rejected the targets as a police case. And instead of raising that sort of question to defend their project against the attack, because they needed an empty space, for example, in order to the idea to have any meaning.
So in fact, there was no discursive. They made no reaction. They didn't explain.
They even exempted themselves, yeah, to make a curatorial, to relate curatorial to it. They just said that they were hired by the biennial to make the show, and they had not to do with the invasion, with anything else, because the show was there to be administered by the biennial and so on. So they missed the point.
I think that also in wanting to think about how the curators could have reacted to it, there's also a question of time, because it's a very recent occurrence, and I think you're right in that, and I feel the same way about it. It's difficult to say, to either condemn it or to. I mean, there's also been a lot of very instant. Oh, isn't it great? Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it like an amazing, vital event, which is similarly limited? And I'm hoping that just in time, because the Biennale always produces its catalogue after the event and things always take a little time, that perhaps it will be something that is reflected on, and maybe when the curators have had time to untangle themselves from, I mean, must be a very kind of intense time for them, just because there have been so many debates, that maybe it will be reflected on. That's sort of a more optimistic possibility. But I think that in relation to that, that there is this thing about biennales, they're very short events, and people expect them to resolve themselves in the space of time that they take place. And in a way, it's a shame that Marcio Doctor's proposal wasn't taking on, because there was a real chance here to look at a biennale as a kind of four-year event. And perhaps that's something that could happen in the next biennale, that you cannot say that this biennale did everything it set out to do, but that's probably because it was far more ambitious than most international biennales, and it put itself in a vulnerable position more than most international biennales, which are very kind of normalized. I think there are lots of constructive things that can be recovered from it, in the Beckett sense of failing again in 2 years' time.
My point is that when you do such a radical gesture, you can't know what is going to come. So you have to be prepared. Moacir said about being a strong institution, but also a disposition to sustain what is going to come in putting in discussion. My problem with the response was that it became a policial issue. and there is something arrested. And I think it's interesting to think that they came into the biennial and they tagged the empty walls. They didn't tag any work of art, for example, on the third floor. So it's a kind of, it's an intervention, it's violent, but there is some rules there. You could dialogue with this, I think, in a different way, not putting it in a political, making it a political issue.
That's a very good point. Did everyone hear that? No, I don't know your name. Sylvia mentioned that on the other extreme, the Brazilians from other cities such as Rio did not bother going to São Paulo to see the biennial because they didn't find it worthwhile. And this was one of the points about that the galleries were making as well, that the fact that the biennial was, to use Paulo Sérgio Duarte's term, a diet biennial, meant that the Brazilians themselves from other cities, many of them didn't bother going to São Paulo to view it.
He's Brazilian as well.
Sou brasileiro mal feito, inglês mal feito.
I think that's true in the sense in a, say, in a rational way, in a practical way. You, if you live far away, you want to go to São Paulo to see the empty building, as many international critics and curators and historians didn't bother to go to São Paulo this year. Just.
But that's why I think it kind of argues how strong the concept of empty space is. It doesn't actually entice an audience, especially an audience.
No, but. I agree to a point, but the statement, that's why I said that in the first place it was a statement of self criticism. Had to expose itself. The idea, the original idea, was that the biennial was an institution strong enough to put itself in such a fragile position so that something new could emerge from that position, from that statement. But in the end, to my view, it proved that it wasn't such a strong institution. So it missed the opportunity and became even more fragile than before the process.
I would have to admit that this is also a kind of perverse pleasure in creating a biennale that commercial gallerists and collectors weren't so enthusiastic about, because it was different model, different constituency, and on the completely the other end of the scale, it had this very popularist presence, mainly thanks to the Carson Holler slides being there.
800,000
visitors.
It's interesting because for me that I went there and I didn't know the whole thing that was going on in the backgrounds. It was a very interesting and very strong aesthetic experience to enter the biennial and ask myself what's going on here. I thought I miss the biennial must be somewhere else. I didn't read the newspaper. I think it's not here. What's going on? And it was a very very strong experience. And to begin to think about the institution, the biennial, but also about the art world. And this big events, what does it mean? You see a lot of works and you can connect with anyone. So for me, it was very good. It would be very nice if I could have a talk there, a discussion, you know, that from this point, a real discussion and other ways of, I think, other ways of occupying the space is also on debate. It was interesting because Yanez tells in an interview that he didn't, the curator said he couldn't go everywhere. And he had this question, can I go to the second floor because it's supposed to be empty? But then he felt he couldn't talk because it was one of these rules he made. And he thought he had to go there because he was staying with so many things that would interfere with the other work. So he went there to the second floor. And it was interesting because when I was there, I saw a performance happening or something that when I read his interview, I realized that wasn't performance to him, but I didn't know. So it was so unexpected for me, this group doing something with a big sphere. It wasn't planned. And I didn't know what was it. It was a gift to him. So these things, I think, is interesting. But
just a comment about a previous question. When I read an interview with Vivi Mesquita that was published in English like 1 month after he was announced as a curator, and he did answer the question if he's the choice, if he chooses to have an empty floor, if was connected with a money issue or a time issue. And he says that it was not a problem of money, but it was a problem of time. And he explained his greater idea about the void. That make me think why he didn't make a teamwork and shared, ask more curators to help him to do the biennial, or and we can see that it was not a problem of budget, because he invited many people to go to the biennial for the discussions that have there. And I can imagine that it were like international people, and I imagine that it shouldn't be, they should have money to do that, to invite people to go there. And anyway, just a little comment about that.
Yeah, I read in the press that the money wasn't so short after all. But the figure was announced. I heard it was eight.
Eight?
Yeah. Eight million. Yeah. But and he did have initially a team. There were three curators working on it. But I think the time issue is more in terms of securing the transportation of the work, and so it wouldn't. The fact that he has a team working on it. And there is money. I think that wouldn't be sufficient to secure a normal biennial.
No, I can't say because the only thing that I can say is that when I was contacted from the biennial, there was no certainty at all about the budget. It was completely. Had to accept, take it in completely ignorance what is going on in the future about the budget the curator we had to work with to make the exhibition. So we had to make a project without no knowledge in advance about how much we could count on, which is something you have to admit very difficult to work in that condition, under that conditions, those conditions.
And I think also that there's a lot of parts of the project that were really expensive that were, and time consuming that were really invisible, and that hopefully will happen if the budget has grown in the time being, like to publish a lot of publish an entire series of press responses to every Biennale that's taken place since 1951, and to organize the archive of photographs. And I think it's these very long-term, very non-visible aspects of the Biennale project which make me glad that they haven't decided to just spend the money, you know, in the short period of time that a Biennale is given, and hopefully this Biennale will sort of stretch beyond the, you know, few months of its existence and be thought more of as a kind of long-term project. And that's I think that's a kind of lasting legacy. Nice word. No, a lasting lesson, at least, or model that...
It depends, because if you say few people will understand, I agree, but it's not a point of understanding. It's how they connect and dialogue with this 40 young people that came. They are from the suburbs. They heard, they came and did an intervention that wasn't a dialogue with the elite, wasn't understanding, but they did something. And, you know, this something was...
It would be much more violent to present a Biennale, an empty Biennale.
Yeah.
It's the act of Bichesin, or the act of making the Bichesin.
I know what you mean, but what I think is, if you create an empty space and the people comes and do this because they are... feeling aggressed by the emptiness, then you can discuss which space is there or not, or no, for everyone. You could, but they didn't. So this is a very lost of opportunity, I think. Hello.
But there is a, I mean, it depends if you're talking about the participation of a kind of a wide section of the population within the exhibition itself as producers of art, artifacts or whatever, or in terms of the participation as audience. I wasn't sure which one you mentioned. But in terms of audience, the Biennale is quite popular. It has an incredible, especially when they stopped charging entrance fees.
No, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that. But wherever you think about the biennial, I think that there was a response to it. Either to the critical response that Michael alluded to in his presentation, the Pichadori's reaction. So there was a response. In my opinion, the weakest point of the whole process was that response was not taken back by the curatorial and by the Biennial Foundation itself, in order to continue the dialogue. There was a lot of rich interventions in that sense. Even the fact that the people were attracted by the sliders, by Carsten Hollis, similar to the one you presented here at Tate Modern, without noticing anything else in their way up to the third floor in order to slide downwards. That was something that to think about, this sort of work and the relationship between art and diversion, something like that. I think that's the problem was that the dialogue was not take a step further.
I think this will have to be the last question.
It seems like a kind of fracture between a collectivity and the institution, the theme of art, the empty space and violence. And it suggests me this kind of gap of fracture. Is for you is something that's going to follow, to the fracture is going to widen or to narrow in some way in the future if there are similar examples in art or music or other cultural expression in Brazil.
Maybe what most politicians in Brazil would like to do a response to it. I mean, not in terms of the arts world, but in terms of, I mean, in terms of the Brazilian society in general, art world being a mural, a symptom to it. I don't know. I think that's an open question. It depends. I think that many of Brazilian artists in their works present that openness of Brazilian society, sort of ambiguity, contradictory elements which are present in their works, which in a way represents or it's a symptom of the condition of Brazilian society nowadays, sort of openness which can be more cohesive in the future or can be completely destroyed, broken, the sociability of which helps the counts together.
It's a question.
Suspension.
Okay, thank you all very much for coming, and I'm afraid we have to end now.